Transmitting sound. Download complete. Now launching audio stream. It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
This week, we welcome psychologist and professor Dr. Frank Farley to the show to talk about the Luca Rocco Magnotta case. This story has captured the headlines over the last couple of weeks, and Dr. Farley gives his analysis as to what's been going on in the mind of Magnotta after he allegedly killed and dismembered Chinese exchange student Jun Lin. We then switch gears and speak with youth expert Jill Tippograph about summer camps and which type is the best for your child. Gina Lee is here with the Love Zone, and we have an excellent remix featuring Elton John.
Capture your need for sound.
We often hear stories in the media about some crazy person who took another person's life in a gruesome act. Sometimes the suspect is the last person you could imagine doing something so terrible. Other times, it's as if the person is crying out for attention. Luca Rocco Magnotta is a Canadian man who was recently arrested for allegedly killing and dismembering a Chinese exchange student in his apartment. Here to help us understand what goes on inside somebody's head before, during, and after they commit a heinous crime is Dr. Frank Farley, former president of the American Psychological Association, a psychologist and professor at Temple University in Philadelphia. Dr. Farley, thank you again for joining us on the Kelly Alexander Show.
Happy to be here, Kelly.
Now, Dr. Farley, from what you know of the Magnotta case, would he be described as a psychopath?
Well, you know, here's my feeling about him as I've read it all. And if it's all true, he is a way beyond almost any category that we have at the moment. There's a handful of people like that, you know, who get a lot of media attention, who are just so far, so extreme in human behavior that we in psychology and psychiatry simply don't have a label that works for them. Psychopath would certainly be, I think, one of the adjectives you would use, but there may be others. And again, we really don't have, at that extreme, we don't have enough clear cases to make much of a sort of profile, if you will. Jeffrey Dahmer in the States, you know, he killed something like 30 young men and ate some of them. His refrigerator was full of decapitated heads and things of that sort. He's an example of somebody who was so far beyond that we really don't know what made him tick. And then he got killed in prison, so he never was studied very much. Magnotta, he seems to be just as gruesome. He doesn't seem to have done nearly as much as Jeffrey Dahmer, but hopefully maybe he's been caught in time. I think that's very important. But yeah, he's deeply, deeply disturbed. You can't get more disturbed. And we could call him a psychopath, we could call him just a crazy person, a madman, a deeply evil person. I think that looking over his history, one of the things that struck me was the thrill value of what he did. He seemed to have thrill-seeking qualities, sort of pushing the envelope. The animal torture, for example, then all of the things he was telling his transsexual lover of several years ago, about how he loved killing, he'd been killing animals, and he would really like to kill others, and he would like to kill his family. And the relentless publicizing, that's a sort of a thrill-seeking quality. You know, going online, websites, showing everything that he was doing, his killing of animals, and ultimately his killing of Mr. Lin in Montreal. And, you know, attempting to get on a reality show. When he was in England recently, just in the last few months, he tangled with some journalists, and he sent letters to the BBC, emails to the BBC and to the Sun newspaper, and he talked about the next thing he would do would be a lot worse than with small animals. So he was kind of a publicity hound, and again, that's a quality, you know, that you'll often see in a kind of thrill-seeking person. So it's a recipe, and I think that in that recipe is a sort of psychopath, probably some genetic factors here, you know, who knows, maybe he's just picked up an extremely rare combination of genetics, and then problems in his family, apparently it was a very troubled family. And then the thrill-seeking, you put that all together as a recipe and you get what we are witnessing.
Is thrill-seeking a quality of a psychopath, Dr. Farley?
Yes, some psychopaths do that, show that quality, but not all. You know, it's not hard science. I wish it was, but maybe in 50 years. And, you know, no one person fits the mold perfectly. That's been the problem with profiling. But yes, many psychopaths can be thrill seekers.
With regards to this case and this individual, Mignotta, does he rank, again, in somewhere with the Dahmers of the world and the John Wayne Gacys, even though, to our knowledge, he has allegedly only killed this one person?
Yes, he does. I have no doubt that he does. He just didn't have as long a run as they did. John Wayne Gacy had many, many years of killing boys and then burying them under his floorboards, for gosh sakes, in Chicago. And Jeffrey Dahmer was several years. Mignotta just hasn't had the track record here, and thank God he's been captured. So I think that's going to be the end of his career. But he shows the same signs, you know, very public. Well, Jeffrey Dahmer wasn't so public, by the way. He did most of his things in private, but John Wayne Gacy was the community clown, for gosh sakes, and was well known in the community and used to don clown, you know, costumes and attend gigs for, you know, kids and so on. And Mignotta's got that quality. He just, he's a lot of his evil, if you will, has been expended on animals and so on, and only, you know, in the last 2 weeks, it seems, we hope, it's the end of it, that he got into doing the same thing for humans. But he's cut from the same cloth, in my opinion.
And in your opinion as well, you know, with John Wayne Gacy and with Jeffrey Dahmer, they were able to go on, you know, these sprees for a long time and not be caught. Do you see a reason why he was caught quickly this time, this Mignotta? Like, is it because of his thrill-seeking? Was he too public with how he was doing things, whereas maybe the other ones were able to keep more private their evil doings?
Absolutely. Bingo. That was the whole thing. He seems to have an insatiable appetite for publicity. And that's often a quality of thrill seekers because it's exciting. You know, how many people, you know, want to be on TV and so on? And so that's a thrill. And he had that quality in his recipe. And Jeffrey Dahmer did not have that. John Wayne Gacy had a little bit, but it wasn't connected to his crimes. He kept his crimes private. In fact, his publicity covered his crimes in the sense that he was, you know, sort of liked in the community, doing the clown thing, you know, on a regular basis at different functions. And so his was a little bit different. His publicity was to cover a crime. And in a sense, Mignotta's publicity is to reveal a crime. And so that's really quite different. But they're both out there in the public, but in different ways.
Are you surprised, Dr. Farley, that it took him this long to graduate to a human being, because it just seems like this animal killing has gone on for quite some time, and it just seems like all of a sudden it was this epic leap to, you know, killing a human?
That's exactly right. And, you know, it makes you worry. Are there other bodies that we don't know about somewhere? And given his publicity hound side, hopefully this is the only one. Because earlier ones, he might well have found some way to publicize as well. But the internet, you know, didn't have as many websites. You know, he posted this thing on bestgore.com, and that wasn't around 10 years ago that I'm aware of. And there weren't nearly as many such access 10 years ago. But, you know, as a transsexual lover of his 10 years ago was saying in interviews, he was talking about killing then. And one thing that he pointed out, it's sort of interesting that Mignotta had a real serious problem with anger control, anger management. So that needs to be put into the recipe also. And she said he used to get into fights all the time on the street and everywhere else. So a very disturbed person, and he may have killed people in the past. We don't know. My guess is probably not, given his publicity seeking. but it's possible.
Joining us on the program is Dr. Frank Farley, former president of the American Psychological Association, a psychologist and professor at Temple University in Philadelphia. Now, Dr. Farley, I am an avid watcher of Criminal Minds, so I'm going to use a statement that I've heard on that show, and you can tell me if it's accurate. Do you think that there was some sort of stressor that caused him to all of a sudden exacerbate and leap to this act, potentially?
I don't know. It's possible. You know, I haven't interviewed the guy. Not much has come out at all so far. It's a hearsay from questionable sources. But it's possible that he went through some sort of process of graduation, just getting gradually worse and worse and worse. That is possible. Or something triggered this one in particular. You know, what was it about Mr. Lin? Was there something there that sort of maybe arouses anger? Did he resist him in some way, in ways maybe that other lovers had not? And who knows? Is there racism involved? I don't know. That's a possibility that should be put on the table. These cases, I mentioned profiling a moment ago. Criminal profiling is an extremely weak, a very weak science. And it's way oversold in the media. And so we don't really have good, clear profiles of most categories or most types of crimes and criminals. We don't have them. And so I always, you know, tell people to take it with a grain of salt. You know, when you see things on TV talking about, you know, this person has got the profile of a serial killer, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, they realize those shows capitalize on that. But there's a serious question about the science. So it's hard to fit him into any kind of a model. Frankly, he seems different in some respects. His recipe has some other ingredients. You know, the thrill-seeking part is pretty unusual. I mean, it's quite extreme in his case, publicity being a form of thrill-seeking. The TV, trying to get on television, relentless posting of things on the internet. You know, writing letters to the media that are really self-revealing letters and over his signature. So that's kind of unusual. It's hard to find a serial killer or a mass murderer and so on who have that MO. So he may have a lot of his own unique qualities.
Were you surprised looking at him physically to think that he could carry off what he carried off? Because he doesn't seem to be a very big man.
Not at all. 135 pounds and what, 5'6" or something?
Mm-hmm.
No, a thin guy. Well, that's not hard to do. You drug somebody, or while they're asleep. My prediction is what he did with Mr. Lin was that while he was asleep, he slit his throat. Now, his throat was slit. And he was also stabbed with an ice pick and, oh, my God, all sorts of horrible stuff. But you have to immobilize the person first, and my guess is that either he drugged him or he was sleeping and it just took one slice and Mr. Lin couldn't breathe. And then he might have, you know, in a sense, I don't like the word, but finished him off with other, you know, he had an ice pick and all sorts of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And the publicity was at the centerpiece of this thing. He had a camera rolling throughout the whole horrific activity. That's pretty different. Very few mass murderers or serial killers have done that. And so he's got some unique qualities.
If we take a step back and again look at his, I guess, history with the killing of the animals, if we look at this in general terms, if someone was to see someone doing this, is this something that should be brought to, you know, authorities' attention or the parents' attention? Because does that mean that you could be graduating to really, really bad things? I mean, I think it's bad enough that you would be wanting to kill an animal, but is this a sign of maybe worse things to come?
It often is, yes. There are very few early predictors of later violence, you know, predictors from childhood that might predict adult violence. Torturing and killing animals is one of the few that has consistently shown some kind of relationship to later violence. And so he had that all over the place. And people knew about it, and they should report it. It's a crime. it's a crime in the States. I'm pretty certain it's a crime in Canada, you know, to kill to kill and torture animals. And so people should have reported him a long time ago, and maybe some help could have been gotten to him. If not help, some, you know, incarceration of some sort. But, you know, and he'd given heads up. He'd made warnings that next victims would not be small animals, etc. So it seems to me there are a lot of red flags along his history in the last several years, suggesting that, you know, he was a bad guy and he had some very bad and criminal intentions, but nobody did anything about it. You know, that's why it's so important. That's why I was so impressed with the animal rights people who started tracking him and trying to run him down and find him through the internet. That's wonderful, and I commend them for that. People, you know, when you see this kind of behavior, pay attention. What people post on the internet, you know, there's some horrific things. The two killers in Columbine, you remember Columbine, the school in the States, where how many kids were killed, 30 or so, 20 or 30?
Yeah, there was a lot.
They were all over the internet. They were into Nazi insignia, Nazi regalia, Nazi stories, a lot of horror stuff on the internet. And they wrote horrendous things in some school essays that, you know, nobody did anything about. And we have to pay attention if we're ever going to get on top of this kind of crime.
Now, from what I understand, with him specifically, Mignotta, he has a habit of assuming different identities. I believe he went as Eric Clinton, Kirk Newman. He even had a Russian name, I guess, Vladimir Romanov. He also lied about having a connection, apparently, to Canadian sex killer Carla Homolka. Police have confirmed that he actually dated Homolka in the past, this according to them. So with all of this untruths going on with him having, you know, pretending to be someone he's not, you know, all these sort of lies, is that also a quality of a psychopath to be, you know, spinning all these yarns?
Often, yes. And it's also exciting, you know, creating different identities. You know, we do it, all of us as kids and so on. We like to, you know, get in different identities, playing a pirate, you know, or whatever. And that was one of his, that's part of his recipe, part of his MO. And it was probably quite exciting to do it, trying out all these different identities and changing his name and so on. Some of that does strike me as someone with a pretty high IQ, which would be interesting to find out. So, for example, on his website, he has stuff there in Arabic, in Russian, in English, on his website. So that's kind of unusual, and it sort of made me speak a high IQ. I'm going to assume that once he is returned to Canada, is he back in Canada now?
I know he's supposed to be very soon because, from what I understand, he you know, he waived his right.
Okay.
So he'll be extradited.
Okay. Well, you know, he'll be going through all sorts of psychological testing, and it would be interesting to find out what kind of an IQ he's got. So, but all the dress up, the imposter phenomenon, in my judgment, that's really a part of the kind of the thrill-seeking part of this guy, because it's quite exciting to do that. It's quite exciting to fool people, to convince them of something that's false, etc.
Would it be fair to say, Dr. Farley, that inside him, he has a perfect storm going on in the fact that, you know, what you've just described, he does sound like a very highly intelligent human being, but yet his emotions of this thrill seeking and the excitement seem to have brought about his downfall? Because if he is that smart, you know, he could have potentially stayed under the radar for years, but instead he let this thing kaboom and he got caught.
Yes. He may lack practical intelligence, as we call it, you know.
Okay.
Practical intelligence would help you stay hidden from the law. He didn't seem to have that. If anything, he was out front all the time. Another thing, too, you know, that struck me about him is this. There's no evidence of empathy that I can see anywhere here, you know. And so that's another, I think, part of the puzzle, part of his recipe. And he himself talked about how he said to somebody once, "Look in my eyes, I'm empty."
Oh, wow.
And, yeah, now that's a scary thought. And one possibility there might be, well, he's trying to fill himself with sensation, you know, seeking excitement, stimulation, pushing the envelope to the farthest you can possibly do it. And that means blood and gore and violence and so on. And sort of filling that void with something, with sensation, with extreme emotion of some sort or extreme activity. But, and she mentioned it too, his lover of a decade ago, the transsexual lover, I think her name was Nina, if I'm not mistaken, but, you know, she talked about the empty quality about him.
And I wanted to ask you, in your knowledge of, you know, the likes of Jeffrey Dahmer and John Wayne Gacy and now this guy, will they, or, you know, obviously the other two have passed away now, but was there any sense of remorse? Like, will he follow along in that thinking, like, there will never be a sense of remorse about this?
Well, can you believe a sense of remorse in such people?
Right. Okay.
I don't. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't give it a moment's thought if they said, I feel remorse. You know, Jeffrey Dahmer having killed 30 and eaten many of them and so on. I mean, it's, to me, the word remorse doesn't work, doesn't apply here whatsoever. And he may mouth that for whatever reason. Who knows? Maybe mm-hmm. to get a, you know, sometimes judges will vary a sentence if the person states remorse. I've never understood that of judges, and you can't believe it anyway. We have no perfect lie detector that will detect if someone's saying, I feel remorse. Is that true? We don't know. And particularly when it can help you out in a sentence,
right,
in a court. So I wouldn't believe anything he says on that line.
And, you know, you and I have spoken in the past about, you know, many different serial killers and how they operate. And I know that you have said in the past that even though they get lumped into the serial killer category, you know, there's so many different aspects to each of them that they're really not all that similar. And it's hard to predict, you know, who's going to do what and how things are going to happen. And with this case, what can authorities and, you know, medical professionals take away from it? You know, will this be of any help at all in the future for understanding and preventing, you know, this behavior in others?
I think it might. I think it would. The key flag here is his publicity seeking as a sign. The postings online, they were horrendous, and clearly attention should have been paid to those. You know, the Montana lawyer who kept phoning everybody, the Toronto police, the Montreal police, even the Miami police, because he'd spent some time in Miami. He had seen this gory video, and he was trying to alert the authorities, and he just got blown off all the time. Well, that shouldn't happen. Gory dismemberings that may or may not be real but look real on online, every one of those should be paid attention to. So that's one thing to take away, which is take seriously the new world of the new online world. Other things were his utterances. You know, words matter. And he's been saying for a long time that, you know, he's going to do more than just kill animals. And he's been killing animals. And people around him know that. And he's told them. Nobody did anything. And so, again, words matter. Take them seriously if they're these kind of words. Other than that, it's hard to see. You know, he seems to have kept his nose clean, if you will, by and large, over these last several years. Not much of a criminal contact or police contact, but a lot of contact with the public. And so, therefore, somebody like him, you know, can fall between the cracks if the public doesn't do something. The police can't do it all. They're overwhelmed with crime, you know. And so the public's got to pick up some of that slack. And clearly it didn't happen here, but it should happen in any comparable kinds of depictions going forward. The online stuff and then the kind of utterances that a person makes.
Okay. Dr. Farley, thank you so much for your insight today. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome. Anytime.
That's Dr. Frank Farley, former president of the American Psychological Association, a psychologist and professor at Temple University in Philadelphia.
Stand by.
The Love Zone with Gina Lee
on The Kelly Alexander Show.
Welcome to The Love Zone. I'm Gina Lee, and today we're talking about a little green-eyed monster. You know the one. It's called jealousy. Have you ever been in a relationship with a jealous person? Or do you get jealous when you're in a relationship? Sometimes feelings of jealousy creep up on you out of nowhere. Maybe because your partner is still in touch with their ex, or when you're out in public, they get a lot of attention from potential competition, and it puts you on edge. Or maybe it's your partner that gets a bit antsy every time you talk to someone of the opposite sex or decide to have a night out with your friends. None of us are immune from the emotion of jealousy, but it's something that we should be vigilant in avoiding, as it can ruin a relationship very quickly if allowed to fester. The best way to get rid of jealousy is to get to the root of why you feel the way you do. What are the triggers? Identify and nullify them. Let's go back to the example of the ex. Say your partner still talks to their ex, and that makes you uncomfortable. You need to communicate that to them. Find a solution. If it's not possible for them to stop talking to their ex, say because they have a child with them, then they need to be open with you about the nature of their contact. If you know exactly what they're talking about, speakerphone is great for this, then you don't have to entertain any jealous thoughts based on assumptions. I know of couples who give each other the passwords to their phone, email, Facebook, and Twitter accounts so that there is complete transparency between them. Not everyone would feel comfortable doing this, but it's an option in the quest to build trust. Trust. That's really the issue with jealousy, isn't it? Not trusting that your partner is truthful, faithful. Not trusting that you are worthy of being truthful and faithful too. Those who don't trust like to control. If I can't trust that you'll be faithful to me, then I'll make you be faithful. What manifests out of that is a paranoia that poisons. Here comes the constant phone calls and texts with the, "Where are you? Who are you with? Why didn't you call me back?" Then it's the, "Were you looking at her? Were you looking at him? You're cheating on me, aren't you? Just admit it, I know you're lying. You won't look me in the eye." Yeah, not pretty. Don't feed the green-eyed monster. It will devour you eventually. However, when it starts to lash its tail, don't ignore it either. If you find yourself getting jealous often in your relationship, it could be because there is a reason to be suspicious. Or maybe there is something your partner is deliberately doing to put you in a position of insecurity. Some people like to use that emotion as a way of manipulation in order to keep a person attached to them. It's an unhealthy way to orchestrate a relationship, and it's bound to backfire eventually. When it comes to jealousy, you really have to look at everything with a clear vision and evaluate whether you're just being too paranoid or if there's a more sinister situation at play. Trust your instincts, and if you have level-headed friends, see if you can get an objective perspective. Again, let your partner know how you're feeling, because if someone loves you, they will do all they can to make sure you feel secure in that love. We all come with a history of past hurts, so what may seem innocent to them may be a red flag to you. So you have to find a common ground that you can both stand on. Jealousy is a seed that you don't want to water in a relationship. It'll become a weed that will choke the life out of anything you grow together. So the minute you see it sprout, pluck it out.
About my feelings, the way that I deal with.
With the weather heating up and kids chomping at the bit for school to be over, it's time to gear up for summer vacation. Summer camp is a great way to nurture your child's talents and to give them a taste of being away from home and making new friends. To talk all about this is professional summer planner and youth expert Jill Tippergraph to help you make the right summer camp choice for you and your children. Jill, welcome to the Kelly Alexander Show.
Thanks. It's my pleasure to be here.
Jill, how can parents gauge when their child is ready to go to summer camp?
Well, if we're talking about overnight camp versus day camp, which one?
You can explain both.
Okay. So I think in terms of day camp readiness, it has to do with a child being able to separate from a parent for an extended period of time where they are used to listening to other adults. Oftentimes, if it's day camp, a camp really does want to make sure that the child is toilet trained, so I think that's a physical barometer. And then I think a child has to be able to be slightly independent, follow instructions, be able to participate in activities. Usually, if a child has gone to preschool, it's a good precursor to a day camp. And when it comes to day camp readiness, a parent has to really think about the length of the day and the maturity of the child. And I think that those things go in tandem and are the kind of the first step in understanding if your child is ready for a day camp experience. When it comes to overnight camp, a lot of it has to do with, again, physical maturity, but even more so, being able to take care of yourself and being able to care for your surroundings and not be reliant on your parents, as well as being able to separate for an extended period of time and be able to make new friends, things of those sorts. So I think children often give parents indications before they even start to think about it themselves. I know with my own children, when it came to overnight camp, I remember they're coming home from day camp the summer before and telling me they were bored and needing more entertainment, which is an indication they're ready for more.
Okay. Now, what happens if the kid is ready and the parents are not? Meaning, like, you know, there's no real reason why the kid couldn't go, but maybe, you know, you were hesitant yourself as a parent because maybe you had a bad experience when you were a kid, or for whatever reason, you know, but the parents aren't ready, but the kid is.
I think it's normal. I think that a lot of parents feel what they call camp sick or child sick, when a child would feel homesick. And that's very normal because you're used to being with your child all the time. And even if they're away during the day or they've gone to day camp, that parents are nervous because they're not going to be there for their child or they're going to miss their child, which is all very, very normal. But it's key that a parent keep their own apprehension and anxiety separate. We all know that our children pick up on our feelings and emotions even before we share them. And so you need to know that you have to withhold that, find a way to camouflage it, and to have maybe a spouse or a partner or a friend with whom you can talk and whom you can confide so that you can separate those feelings from your child.
And is it better actually, you know, for the kids to go to summer camp with a friend or alone? Like, does that alleviate some of the stress on both parts, like the kid and the child?
Well, I think if you're talking about day camp, yes. And I find that most parents do have their children go to some type of a day camp where they know a child because they're young and they like the familiarity. But when it comes to overnight camp experience, my preference is for children, if possible, to go on their own because they should own the experience. They should be able to be accepted unconditionally and really be who they are. It's oftentimes that I hear from parents, and I know factually from experiences, that that camp is a place where a child really becomes who they are, and they get to find other kids who have their interests as opposed to live in a home community where they try to find children who have similar interests or dispositions or personalities. So my preference would be own it alone, but if a child needs to go with someone they know, I love it when it's a relative or if it's a friend from a different community who they don't see every day, so that it doesn't really impede upon their making friends with other children and especially put them in different bunks.
Okay, that's fantastic. I think that's a great way to look at it because I think a lot of parents would want them to go with someone they know, but like you're saying, it gives them a chance to become their own person. So I think that's really important for someone to remember. Now, how do you actually, you know, tell parents or recommend to parents that they react if they get, you know, a homesick letter in the mail?
Well, homesickness, just to put a positive spin on it, really means that a child comes from a place where they feel loved and wanted, and that's really wonderful. So I think that that's critical. I talk to parents about doing some prep with their kids before they go off to camp so that they almost have a dry run and they understand that they're going to have certain feelings, and it's doing a little bit of role playing. It's telling a child that this is what you may experience. Not everybody does, but if you have these feelings, they're normal. You might feel them typically at times when we as a family are normally together, and every family has different habits and patterns. Sometimes it's having dinner together, or it's bedtime, or it's in the morning when everybody's getting ready together, and it can happen at different times for children. And so they will, of course, vent and share. I remember my own children writing me articles like, you know, letters like this. And parents have to remember, put it in perspective. But I also suggest to parents, they send their kids to camp with what I call their emotional toolbox, where it's this little box of, you know, little special mementos or memories that a child can look at when they start to get sad and feel close to you again. And it's nothing that's really embarrassing to any other child. It's just like a little special box or an envelope or whatever it might be, or something that comforts them, whether it's pictures or it's music. It's, you know, a token from an amusement park you went to, or a prize from a carnival whenever you went to the beach, whatever it might be. But the flip side, when a parent gets the letter, a parent has to remember that a child wrote this in a moment of angst. And as soon as they wrote it, they went on with their day. A counselor consoled them, or they started getting busy with an activity. It's during the downtime that these things happen. So it's during rest hour when letters are supposed to be written. Kids are relaxed, and they're not busy, so it's easy for them to think of things that are unhappy to them, so they'll miss people. But I always say to a parent, give it a little time. See if you get another letter, if there's a pattern. But certainly if you're a first-time parent, you should call the camp, and you should just let them know that you got this letter and you're not overly anxious, but you just want to alert them in case this continues, or in case they just want to keep it in mind and mention to the counselor just to keep an, you know, have a heads up on whether this child is experiencing some homesickness feelings. But always feel you can call the camp, but make sure you speak to the right person who knows your child.
On the show with us this week is professional summer planner and youth expert Jill Tipograph. Check out her website, everythingsummer.com. Jill, it seems that there are, you know, camps to suit just about every hobby and interest. So how should parents and children go about choosing the right one?
Well, my own philosophy about camp for children is, and I'll talk about overnight camp primarily, is that it's really best to start in a traditional overnight camp experience where there's a lot of structure and supervision, exposure to different activities, and where there's a lot of time invested in nurturing the development of a child. When you're in that kind of environment, the same people are working with your kids, your children spend more time with their bunk mates, so it's easier to get to know them and to feel bonded and a part of a community. When you go first to camps that are specialty camps, those camps are there to make sure your child is learning a skill or pursuing a hobby, but they're not as invested as a traditional camp is in nurturing that child's development and making them feel like they belong in the community. And they're often very short term, so you can't really expect a child to get as much out of that from an emotional perspective, a growth perspective. So I like when kids have that under their belt first, and it's oftentimes at these traditional camps that a child, because they're exposed to so many activities, they find something they're have of interest that they didn't know they had before. And then maybe after a few summers, they say, you know, I really, really do want to pursue theater, or I really, really do want to pursue this particular sport or this water activity or adventure or whatever they really love. And that's okay then, because they've had this foundation of knowing how to live away from home, you know, resolve problems, know what it's like to be supervised and watched by other people, collaborate, teamwork, all of those things that go into the benefits of going to camp. And then you have, as you said, all these specialty opportunities. I feel similarly for day camp, especially because children are so young and they need that exposure, they need that management. But I know that it can be Wonderful to know there's so many activities out there, but I just caution parents when they look at these differences between traditional and specialty camps, they think about the development of their child.
Now, what conversations or little chats, you know, should parents be having with their kids before sending them off to summer camp?
Well, I think the first one is if they are concerned about the homesickness, that they talk about this as a potential reality. I wouldn't dwell on it. I would say it's normal. The other thing that I would make sure that the parent talks to the child about is knowing who to turn to in a time of need. It's very important they know the chain of command and who they should go to first or second or third, when they should try to go to the camp director. Certainly, if they have any type of emotional or medical needs, a child needs to be briefed on how the camp will handle it and vice versa. I think that it's important for parents to talk to kids about group living and getting along with bunkmates and learning how to make friends with new people and being open to trying new things, because that's what camp is all about. I dwell on the positive. I don't think that parents need to go over everything in a lot of detail, because that can be overwhelming for children, but give them a taste, give them a sense of what their day will be like. Oftentimes, camps have on their websites or materials, or they'll send sheets home to parents ahead of time in terms of what your child's schedule may look like. Have them maybe go over the videos and brochures again so they can visualize where they're going to be during different activities. So when they get to camp and the camp does spend time training the kids and having orientation, they go, oh, yeah, I remember that. I remember seeing that in the video. This is where I'm going to be doing tennis, and this is where I swim, and this is where we do the boating. So as much familiarity that you can share with your child ahead of time, the more comfortable they're going to be in their new surroundings.
Jill, I don't want to be negative by any stretch of the imagination, but I guess because in the news, you know, the last several years, and it just seems more evident the last few years, I guess the phenomenon as known as bullying, it happens everywhere now, and especially with social media, it follows a kid home. Do you have concerns about bullying happening while they are physically away from home, maybe for a 2-week stay or maybe even longer?
Well, I actually feel that camps actually do sometimes a better job of dealing with bullying than what happens in schools these days. And I'm not making a blanket statement. I'm saying that the camps are so sensitive to this. They do extensive training with the staff during staff orientation. They bring in specialists. They have specialists who come back throughout the summer to work with the staff and work with the children. They are very aware of the signals of what a bully is and how a child can feel bullied, and they have zero tolerance. So the camps are fast to send the kids home when they see this. And the other beautiful thing about camps, or at least overnight camps, is they don't allow the electronics. So the cyberbullying, where most of this takes place, can't occur at camp because that's not allowed. There's no technology. So it removes the tool that has enabled so many, unfortunately, children to, create this bullying atmosphere. So I feel better about how bullying is managed in camps because of zero tolerance than I do at home. And I think that if parents are concerned about this, they should definitely familiarize themselves with the anti-bullying policies that camps are so vocal about. They often put it in their handbooks, they put it on their website, they tell parents about it ahead of time, because, all it takes is one experience in camp to impact an entire group. I also feel good about how camps manage it because I've seen firsthand when I visit camps in the summer, I'll be there on an off day and I look for certain things when I'm observing. And I remember being at a camp last summer when I was observing a group of older girls being on the porch and staff member talking to them, the girls looking very sullen. And I said to the camp director, "What's going on?" And he said, "Well, there was a bullier and we sent her home. And this is how we deal with it in terms of after the effect." So they understand why we had to send the girl home, because there are people who feel they didn't do anything to me, why are they leaving? So I think that it's great what the camps do in terms of making a learning lesson out of it and making sure that everybody understands how this type of behavior is not acceptable. So I feel fairly good about how camps handle this, but there are always exceptions. But I do feel that this is an absolute priority for them, and the camps go out of their way to train and manage this.
Can you talk about the fact that you and your team, you know, visit camps in season and interview these directors? Because I'm assuming you see all kinds of things. And I guess, you know, what kinds of things are you looking for? And what are some signs that maybe a camp is or is not well organized?
Well, we're out there meeting during the summer as much as we can, although there's a short window to meet all the directors, but we do speak with them throughout the year as well as watching firsthand. And I look for more observations than I do in terms of verbal interaction, at least me with the director asking questions. I want to see how campers are being treated. I want to see not just how they're being treated by staff, but how they're being treated by their peers. And how is the communication between all of them? I also look for how a camp is maintained. I look especially when I'm touring with a camp director and they see some perhaps small refuse on the ground, if they bend and they pick it up and put it in the garbage can, because to me that's a reflection of how much they care about their property. So I love when I see that.
Mm-hmm.
I think that I am also looking for how the kids are being instructed. You know, from a supervisory perspective and also from a skill development perspective. And are the kids attentive? Is the staff attentive? I'm also looking to make sure that the kids are properly dressed with the proper attire, meaning for, let's say, activities. During soccer games, are they wearing the shin guards? During baseball, are they wearing the helmets? Things like that. When they're in the water, you know, that everyone in a boat is wearing a life jacket, or they have their buddy system. I look for all kinds of things like that. When they're in the woodworking, I want to make sure that they're wearing the goggles. So safety is really paramount. So I look for that as well. And I go into all the dining rooms, and I look at how they're maintained. The directors take me into the kitchen so I can see how it's cleaned. I work with a lot of kids who have food allergies. So I'm very interested in going into the kitchen and speaking with the food managers or the chefs and understanding how they manage the meal preparation for these children. And there are many camps now that have cabinets with sealed containers with certain foods that these kids can eat. I've been at camps where they bring the food out into a certain area where it's labeled with a child's name and nobody else is able to sit there, and their friends can come over and converse after they've eaten. But it's important for this child to be protected because some kids have very, very severe food allergies. So I go the gamut in terms of seeing everything that I can see to make sure that a camp is being well run. I also like to go into the office and see how things are managed. Is someone answering the phone? Is there a chain of command going on? Things like that.
So a question I would have for you as well is, when we're talking about kids that are a little bit older, you know, into their teenage years, are summer programs like this helpful for them as they navigate their way through being a teenager? It seems like a really positive experience for them to be away and doing things. And, you know, it's always difficult being a teenager. And I'm just wondering if being in a summer program with other kids their age helps them get through some of the turmoil of being a teenager.
I think they definitely help, and I think that summer camps for teenagers offer different opportunities than summer program teen experiences for teens. I think that it's hard for teens to be home in an unstructured setting. That's often when, you know, they might make not the best decisions or get into trouble or create more work for their parents. I think having kids be with their peers is important because they feel that they're the only ones that really understand them, which I think is just part of being a teenager. So they can share together and grow together. I think it's definitely a developmental positive step. I also feel, knowing that these kids are hopefully going off to college, that it's very critical for teenagers to have independent, away-from-home experiences. I speak with college admissions directors. I've interviewed them, and there's a common theme that says that the kids who have independent residential experiences away from their parents before they get to college are the ones that transition better into group living. And that's often one of the biggest issues, is transitioning to group living.
Okay. And I wanted to ask you as well, when it comes to figuring out if you are going to send your child off to summer camp, by what time, or, you know, how far in advance do they need to be registered and ready to go? Because I'm assuming a lot of these slots fill up very quickly.
It depends on the kind of camp that you're looking at. Typically, full season camps, which can be, you know, 6 to 7 weeks long, that don't have other options, tend to fill much earlier because they have a very high return rate, because that's the tradition of camp where you return. I'd say that shorter term camps tend to have a little bit longer of a lead time. So when it comes to full season camps, ideally parents should be thinking a year ahead. That's not to say they can't get in the following fall or early winter, but as the kids' ages increase, the fewer spots remain. And when it comes to shorter session camps, because there's more sessions to choose from, a parent may be able to plan that in the winter. And then if it's, let's say it's like a 1 week specialty camp, parents can sometimes, again, because there's multiple dates, they'll be able to enroll their kids maybe, you know, through the spring. But it's, you know, at this time of year, sometimes there will be spots depending upon the flexibility of the dates and the interests and things like that. But there's no question that the early bird beats the worm, and that allows you time to digest and research and find the right camp. So the more time allowed, I think the better match will be made.
Okay. Now, I wanted to speak about this. You have a book.
My summer, Everything Summer Guide and Planner,
yes.
And it's an overview. It's really a roadmap in terms of how to select day camps, overnight camps, and teen programs, parameters, questions to ask, safety, and for teenagers thinking ahead to college, questions to ask camp directors. It's, as many people who have said to me they purchase it, it's a must-have, they say. So it's available on our website, everythingsummer.com.
Fantastic. Jill, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
It's my pleasure, and I hope all this wisdom helps many of your listeners.
Excellent. That's professional summer planner and youth expert Jill Tipograph. Again, make sure to check out her website, everythingsummer.com.
It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
Well, as per usual, a big thank you going out to my guests. This week, Dr. Frank Farley, Jill Tipograph, and Gina Lee. Now, next week on the show, we are very excited to present to you four-time Grammy Award-winning group, Boys to Men. They talk about being together for more than 20 years, what's the best thing about being on tour, and what to expect next from these three amazing singers. So again, make sure to check out Boys to Men next week on The Kelly Alexander Show. And don't forget to check out our new Twitter account, K Alexander Show, also our Facebook page, Kelly Alexander Show, and our website, www.kellyalexandershow.com. I want to leave you with your inspirational quote of the week, this time coming from Eleanor Roosevelt. The future belongs to those who believe in the beauty of their dreams. Have an awesome week. You and I'll chat soon.